This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're tuned into The Property Show on The Morning Run. It's our weekly take on all things property related, and I'm Sim Wee Boon. It's the last Friday of the month, and as usual, we have the Property Legal Clinic, a segment of the show where we take in listener questions and have our guests weigh in on them. Our guest today is Dato' Ringo Low, the founder and managing partner of Ringo Low & Associates. Good morning and welcome to the show, Dato'. So we'll start off our show today with our first question, which came from Daniel. So this is the situation he's describing. As a new owner of a property, how do I find out who the members of the management committee are? Or do I form a group on my own? And can you also explain the significance of forming such a management committee? Dato, what do you think about this?
Yes, it's an interesting question, Daniel. What you need to do is, firstly, you should have to move around to locate where the management office is. The developers would have provided a space for the management office very much earlier on. I believe that since you're talking about management committee, there would have been the management corporation having been set up. That being the case, they would have elected the committee members at the first annual general meeting of the management corporation. Now, from there, the list will usually be distributed to all the residents. Perhaps you may not have received them. There would also be a list normally at the notice board at the common area where the management committee would relay decisions and information to all the residents. Now, if you still can't get it for whatever reason, your last recourse, you can actually communicate with the commissioner of building that will normally have a list of all the office bearers of the committee. That's a last resort. But generally, you will find it somewhere in the vicinity of your condominium. Now, your next question, you did ask about whether you can form a group of your own. You can do that only at the next annual general meeting, Daniel. You take part in the voting process and you can nominate your own team members, and hopefully you get enough votes to get your team members elected. Now, in respect of your last part of your question, Daniel, about the significance of forming a management committee, of course, it's important. Why? Because the management committee, they are the one that runs the affairs of the maintenance and management of your development. Now, they will decide and pass resolutions regulating the use and whatever that's necessary in respect of governing the management and maintenance of your property. So a lot of important decisions can be made there. So if you want, you should take part in it so that at least you can play an active role in running your development there.
I just want to clarify. So I think sometimes there's some confusion between first-time homeowners when these terms come out, you know, joint management body, management corporation, joint management corporation, like JMB, JMC, MC. Is there a significant difference to these, and are they related with a management committee? How do we differentiate them? Or are they all just the same?
Okay, Vibun. Listeners, as a start, when a property development project like condo or stratified property, it's ready and delivered to the purchasers, usually the developer will run the management of the development. The maintenance and management usually rest on the shoulder of the developer. Thereafter, the developer will start calling for the first annual general meeting of the joint management body. And this is before the strata title is issued. So pending issuance of strata title, the JMB, joint management body, will be the body comprising representatives of the developers and the residents who are elected there at their first AGM, and then they'll run the development. Now, once strata title is issued, it should be run by the management corporation. And that's when the management committee will be formed at its first AGM.
Okay, so we move on to our next question, which comes from Selena. And I'm a new owner of a service apartment in Oakland Road. I find that my current management office to be very restrictive in terms of renovation for my own unit. There are rules like I cannot install a grill of my own design, I cannot hang clothes on my balcony, I cannot choose a different light fixture for my yard or balcony, as well as a whole host of other rules. Is there any way I can challenge these rules? So I think this is a very commonly brought up situation that many of our listeners have brought up before, and even I personally has come upon. So what kind of insights can you give about this, Datuk?
Okay, let's look at the start. When one purchases a property, Selina, when you sign a sale and purchase agreement for your service apartment, I'm sure you recall having signed another set of documents called a deed of mutual covenants. Basically, this deed of mutual covenants would regulate the relationship of all the property owners at that condominium project. They want to make sure that there is uniformity of design, exterior, and whatever things that can be done so that it's more presentable in the long run. So there are rules inside there. And even aside from there, assuming that the deed of mutual covenant did not provide enough rules, usually as well, the developers, when they hand over vacant possession, they would have set a little booklet called the house rules. Now, these house rules will also regulate what sort of grills you can install, whether you can install any grill at all, whether you can keep pets, whether you can hang clothes out on your balcony, whether you can change the exterior facade lightings. Those are the rules that are set by the developer. And mind you, these house rules can also be amended subsequently by the JMB or the MC Management Corporation. So it's all majority rule. Like for instance, I can share with you that we are aware that certain condominium project disallowed Airbnb to be operated by the residents. I'm sure you would have read it in some newspapers as well. Some projects in Montclair, they passed resolutions among the members by way of house rules as well as resolutions at AGM that forbid the residents from letting out their units on a short let basis. So it's not easy to challenge this type of rules that's been set by the residents because the court will always enforce whatever the majority wants. So it's been approved by the majority. I'm afraid it's very difficult to challenge these rules.
Okay, we're going to take a short break for some messages and we'll be back after these. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Property Show on The Morning Run. I'm Sim Wee Boon and I have Dato' Ringo Low, the founder and managing partner of Ringo Low & Associates, here with me today for the monthly property legal clinic. It takes place every last Friday of the month. Earlier, we took a few questions from our listeners. Now, we move on to this other question, which comes from Jonathan. This is the situation that he's described. My condo management has been delaying its AGM since last year, citing COVID-19 issues. There's been suggestions of having virtual meetings, but some are opposed to it because some owners are not that tech savvy and there's doubts that questions might be curtailed because the meeting will be hosted by the management. So Jonathan wants to know, Dato, are there any guidelines, rules or best practices for AGMs during this period? How long can they keep delaying the AGM and what can the residents do to make sure this AGM happens?
Jonathan, a very good question. I think the first place to start to look at would be the Strata Management Act of 2013. Okay, there is provided in the second schedule to the Act rules for the AGM. You can just glance through there, and then it's all quite set up with all the rules clearly drawn, so that it can guide every condominium committee members along in respect of the holding of the AGM. Now, there is also a COVID-19 SOP set by the Malaysian National Security Council, which has been revised on the 18th of March, which also provide the guidelines for AGM, just in case if they need to ascertain the numbers, the venue, and the mode of holding it. Now, the Schedule 2, which I referred to in the Strata Management Act of 2013, there is a Rule 10 Bracket 2 that says that all subsequent AGMs, this is of course after the first AGM having been taken place, all subsequent AGMs shall be held once in each year, provided that not more than 15 months shall elapse between the date of one annual general meeting and the next. So this is basically the guideline, maximum 15 months from the last AGM. Now, I would advise Jonathan that the management committee shall have to hold the AGM within a maximum period of 15 months from the last AGM. However, the management committee may also seek any extension of time from the commissioner of buildings if there is certain valid reason to do so. I don't know, one can come up with a lot of reasons, and the commissioner of buildings is usually quite reasonable to entertain such requests. Now, if for whatever reason the AGM is continually being delayed deliberately, or maybe with mala intention or bad faith, as Jonathan might think or feel so, then an official complaint may be lodged to the Commissioner of Buildings. And then the Commissioner of Buildings will write officially to the Management Corporation and ask them for their valid reason as to why they are not holding the AGM. So that concludes my answer to your question, Jonathan.
What kind of repercussions would happen if they still continue to delay? I mean, are there any bodies that oversee these kind of things? I guess, you know, straight on the point, can they, if the thing doesn't happen, can the residents report police or something like that?
Not necessary to report to police. Actually, the Commission on Building can direct that AGMs be held. You know, Commission on Buildings have got adequate powers under the Act itself. Of course, one can lodge a police report to just put the committee on guard, you know, to sort of exert a little bit more pressure on them. But I'm sure the police will say that, you know, this is a matter between the residents and the Commission on Buildings. You know, should be directed to the Commission of Buildings, who has ample powers to do the necessary.
How has the virtual AGM experience been? Do you have any insights on that? I mean, what has been the challenges and what has made it successful? Do you have any insights into this?
I think just like all the other meetings, like companies' meetings that's taken place, one can run a hybrid sort of a meeting where the committee members are present in a hall, and then one could go by way of Zoom with the residents and then limit the number of residents in there. I don't foresee any major logistic or difficulty in effecting the AGM even during this pandemic. All we need to do is just maintain the SOPs, keep the numbers small in the physical meeting, and allow Zoom or Teams to be used as the medium to raise the issues or to discuss the issues at the AGM. I believe it's been done quite a fair bit already. So I don't foresee that being used as an excuse to say that, oh, we need a bit more time because of the pandemic. I think there are ample provisions to hold AGMs.
Our next question comes from Ofman. I'm a new owner of a service apartment in KL, and I have recently just received the keys to my unit and have gone and is going through the defect checking. I'm very disappointed at the quality of the build. There are multiple leaks, damages to the tiles, poor workmanship on windows, etc., etc. It's been over 30 days since I've submitted the defect report to the management and nothing has been done. I've complained, but my complaint has been pushed around from management to their contractors and back. What are my options? Can I employ my own contractors to fix the defects and charge back to the developer? Thank you. So, Dato, what do you think?
Osman, you can actually refer to your sale and purchase agreement, because there will be a clause in there in respect of defects liability period, where I believe now generally it would be 24 months from the handover date of the property to you, where the developers have the responsibility to ensure that all defects within this 24 months will be attended to and rectified. Now, there's no need for you to go and get your own contractor at this juncture. What you should do, I know you have stated there that it's been 30 days, you've submitted a defect report to them and nothing has been done. But maybe I'm not sure, maybe they're too busy attending to a lot of defects. I really don't know. But 30 days, it's considerably a long period of time. They should have at least acknowledged your defect report and then tell you that they'll come back to you. But if it gets too long, if it's like maybe another 30 days and you can't stand it longer, and then your defects liability period might be expiring, then you've got to act a little bit more urgently. If not, you've got actually 24 months, Othman. You don't have to worry too much. I would suggest before you engage your own contractor, write to the developer, give them an ultimatum, maybe like 14 days or something like that, and say that your earlier complaints have been made, no action was taken. And if they still continue to ignore your demands, you will have to attend to the rectification on your own, at your own cost, and then you will write to the stakeholding solicitors who are holding the 5% of the balance purchase price as stakeholder. Now, you can write to the stakeholding solicitors to inform them that there are defects and that you incurred expenses and you want to make a claim on the stakeholding sum held by the solicitors. Now, then, in that case, the solicitors will find it difficult to release the full stakeholding sum to the developer without accounting for the cost of the rectification of your defects. So there are options that are available for you, Osman.
Okay, so for new owners, sometimes it can get a bit confusing which solicitors they can go to because, you know, from my understanding that there are a few lawyers engaged in the entire process of buying a home, right?
Yeah. You're quite correct because there's a sale and purchase solicitor usually appointed by the developers to do up the sale and purchase agreement and the deed of mutual covenant. There is also the bank solicitors that come in to do the loan documentations for the end financing to pay off the balance purchase price. And of course, there is a stakeholding solicitors. Now, where will you find details of these stakeholding solicitors? It will usually be in the letter when they notify you to collect your keys. The letter of handing over vacant possession, they will normally state down there, the balance 5%, please pay to these solicitors. So and so, the name will be there, the address will be there, the telephone number of the solicitors will be notified there. And that's the stakeholding solicitors. Now, for all defects that you have during the defects liability period, now, the purpose of the stakeholding sum is to satisfy any defects rectification costs that may arise. So you can stake a claim after giving due notices to the developer and their failure to rectify. Then you can spend the monies and then try to claim it back from the lawyers or put the lawyers on notice that you want to make a claim so that they don't release the full sum to the developer. And if they do release the full sum to the developers later on, Othman, you will have a course of action to complain against the solicitors, either to file a suit against them or to lodge a complaint against the lawyers to the disciplinary board regulating all advocates and solicitors.
Our last question is a question coming from me, and I'm sure everyone's been aware with the Convent Bukit Nana school issue in terms that its land lease expiring and it's not being able to renew. Now, we know the developments have come out that the land lease has been renewed for another 60 years, so the situation is resolved for now. But I just want to get your thoughts on this. I mean, how can they ensure that 60 years on, this situation doesn't happen again? Is there any way to reverse a land lease agreement to change it into kind of like can they buy over the lease? Can the lease be granted to the school so that it doesn't have to expire? I mean, what are the options here to make sure that the school will probably last indefinitely?
I think the best solution here would be if the school can be gazetted as a national heritage site. That would offer, to me, the best protection under the circumstances. Because now, looking at the granting of the lease, thankfully, the government of the day has been kind enough and appreciative of what has been done, and then they've renewed the lease for another 60 years. That's really good. But like you said, there is no sense of security. What happens after 60 years? Then it reverts back to the Federal Territory Land Office. And then they could impose new conditions again. So, and to expect them to give you a freehold title in replacement of a leasehold title, I think that would be a tall order to ask. But the other solution, like I've said, if it's gazetted as a national heritage site, then all the stakeholders will feel compelled to uphold the building as a school of historical repute. Now, not far off from where Convent Bukit Nanas is, you've got St. John's Institution, which has been gazetted as a national heritage site by the government of Malaysia in May of 2010. Now, maybe they had the muscle there because the old boys of St. John's comprised of big people, important people like Najib Razak, Hisham Hussein On, the Sultan of Selangor, the current Sultan of Perak as well, you know. So it helps if you can get it gazetted as a national heritage site. But then again, I read in the newspapers as well that the tourism minister, I think Nancy Shukri, did mention that, yes, that they offered to attempt to gazette CBN as a national heritage site. But apparently the sisters, the governing body, were a bit reluctant at that point in time. So I certainly hope that they'll reconsider this attempt again if it's given a chance. That should help to preserve the school as a national heritage.
Okay, and we'll keep an eye on this and see the developments. But, you know, I want to thank you, Dato, for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure, Wibun. It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so that's all the time we have for the Monthly Property Legal Clinic today. I've been talking to Dato Ringo Loh, the founder and managing partner of Ringo Loh & Associates. Join us again next month as we try to answer all your property legal questions. Send your questions to property@bfm.my or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We've got the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next, followed by Enterprise BFM 89.9.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9. The Business Station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.